comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another journey into the world of the strange and unexplained. I'm Kevin Smith, your host. You're listening to The Kevin Smith Show, and we are here because you have a right to know. We are here because you matter. The Kevin Smith Show members community, you've been hearing me talk about it now for several weeks, it's open. It's brand new, high speed, low drag, and there are tons of goodies in there for you, not the least of which are the archives of all the shows, your own blog, friends page, forums, chat, and you can watch the shows live there as well. It's only $7.50 per month, and you get the first 7 days free, so this is a good time to sign up. That comes to $7.50 a month. That comes to 25 cents per day. Think about that. That's less than I was paying for lunch in elementary school in the third grade in 1961. Do you have any idea what an incredibly underpriced deal this is? But you got a lot for that 25 cents. You need what you're missing, and it's all there in the members community. Join tonight. Join the informed. Why not? For those of you who are brand new to the show, you don't know that we have a free weekly newsletter. Truly free, no strings attached, no gimmicks, just free. It's called The K-Files. And it has been around since the year 2000. It's been around for 11 years. Some of the people that are subscribed to the K-Files subscribed way back then in 2000. So it must be a pretty good publication. They have stuck with it. You can get it absolutely free by going to my website, kevinsmithshow.com. When you get there, look right in the middle of your screen, and you'll see the word K-Files. Well, click on it. And once you click on it, you can subscribe. It asks you a very, very difficult set of questions. It asks for your email address. It's really that simple. You just put your email address in there and subscribe. Now, you're going to get a confirmation email, and it has a link in it that you have to use to activate your subscription. If you don't activate it, you won't be getting the K-Files. Okay? So you have to activate it. And we do that to make sure we don't spam anybody. You can unsubscribe anytime you so desire, and it never costs you a penny. So there's no genius in not getting the K-Files. You need to get it. Okay, so if you're not subscribed, get over there and subscribe today. And while you're at it, join our members community. It is, as I said, high speed, low drag, brand new, redesigned digs. You need to be there because you need the information that is there and the special broadcast that we do. Got one coming up real soon. And all you have to do is be a member. We're going to step away for a break. We'll be back with my guest, A.J. Ensor, right after this. My My guest this evening is A.J. Ensor. He's been with us before. He's back with us again tonight, and we're delighted to have him back with us tonight. He is a TV screenwriter. He's a producer. He's an author. A.J., welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you for having me.
When you were on before, we talked about your book, Quantum Leap, and you've revised it and re-released it. Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, there were some criticisms in there, and I took the criticisms to heart, and then I decided that that which I left out of the first, I would go ahead and put it in.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, let's talk about, just in general terms, we'll get into some details in a moment, but in general terms, the title of the book is Quantum Leap. What is it about?
The Quantum Leap is, the Quantum Leap is about us, but the information comes through a friend of mine who I was in the Marine Corps with, and he went into military intelligence, and he spent the first 2 or 4 years of his career doing what most military intelligence people do, and then he spent the rest of his career bodyguarding a guy who I simply refer to as John in the book. That's what he called him, John. And John was not born and raised on this planet. He's from someplace else. And in our terms, John would be considered an anthropologist. So basically, he sits and watches what we do and takes notes. And one of the things that he is watching us do is become a more advanced race. There's a test for people or races that want to join the rest of the, I guess for lack of a better word, it had to be the Galactic Society. And he's watching us go through that. It started in World War II, and I don't know that he's been here since World War II, but it started during World War II, and it's how we, the human race, the Homo sapiens, catch up to the rest of the universe, and that's why it's called a quantum leap. Over a very short period of time of 50 to 150 years, we will catch up very rapidly with the rest of the universe. It's a transformation of a biblical level, so it's a quantum leap.
Okay, I got a question for you. Is the rest of the universe pulling jihad on each other? Is the rest of the universe manufacturing reasons to go to war? And if so, we're headed that direction rapidly.
Well, you see, that's the reason why there isn't a wider contact. That's why there's only a secret, narrow, very limited contact. Mm-hmm. These people are afraid of us.
Hell, I'm afraid of us.
Right. From their perspective.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid of us from our perspective.
Right. From their perspective, we are incredibly primitive.
I agree with them.
And I go into a few of those reasons why in the book, okay? But that's, you know, we were on our own before they showed up. We're still on our own. We're going to remain on our own. They're not going to interfere. Whether or not we get to the quantum leap is totally up to us. I mean, the process is already underway. Mm-hmm. But whether or not we actually get there as a people, no individual can do it by themselves, I guess is what I'm trying to say to you.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll
come back to
all this kind of paranoia. They're going to come, they're going to land, they're going to invade, they're going to make war. That's the way we think. That's not the way they think.
Okay, we'll come back to all of that in just a moment. And I want to get into detail about that in just a moment. But I want to go back to how we got the story, how you got the story. It's a friend of yours who was in the Marine Corps, military intelligence. And how is it that he came to be in the position of bodyguarding this person from another planet? How did he get chosen for that?
Well, Josh was in and of himself an extraordinary individual. He probably had a photographic memory or an eidetic memory. And he was he scored extremely high on every test the military ever gave him. And so he was put into military intelligence in 1984, the beginning of the second Reagan administration. The people, the organization that he was a part of was dissolved. They were an expensive group, but they were an extremely generalized group. If you did something wrong to an American someplace in the world, chances are that Josh or one of his associates or both would have shown up on your doorstep. And so in the second Reagan administration, their group was transferred to civilian operations, probably in Central Intelligence. And he didn't have what he did. He couldn't do unless he went for retraining. He didn't want to go for retraining. He had an extremely high security clearance. I think he probably had the highest you could possibly get. And he was extremely valued by the intelligence community. And so he just got sent on one-of-a-kind, strange missions. And I go into a few of those in the book. And he himself thought it was all very weird that he would get stuck doing these extremely odd things inside the military. And one day he was at a base out in Nevada, I believe it was. I'm not going to tell you it was a particular area or a particular base because I don't actually know. I know it belonged to the Air Force, and I know they were testing in an advanced craft. And Josh was basically, or at least he thought, as he was often assigned to do, to go in and open up the doors, which is something he found extremely annoying. It was an Air Force institution. They had their own security people. Why did he keep getting stuck to do these things? And so he saw a highly advanced craft go through its routines, and he was actually escorting a general or an admiral. I think it was an admiral, actually, to this event. And that is when he was introduced to John. But that's all he was done. He was just introduced to him. He was told he was going with John. He wasn't told who John was, and he didn't ask. Josh was just notorious for keeping his mouth shut. And I think he got advanced in the intelligence community because he was so good at keeping his mouth shut. And it was not until an incident in Australia that he discovered who and what John was or is.
Mm-hmm.
And
what happened in Australia that revealed this to him?
Something incredibly stupid. John liked going out and walking around in nature. He liked nature walks, walkabouts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was a long-distance walker. He just, and I guess if he loved the earth, that's what he loved about it. And on this particular day, they were out walking about, and a boar, which is a wild pig, came out of nowhere and went right for his leg. And he bit right into that thing, and Josh was right there and shot the thing dead immediately, but John was bleeding, and from Josh's point of view, his blood was black. It wasn't actually, I mean, later on he found out it wasn't really black. It was just in sunlight. The red blood cells in his body were so concentrated that in sunlight it looked black.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the entire revelation took place. I mean, John told him who he was and what he was and where he was from. And that's when the revelation started.
Okay.
Somewhere along the line, I found out that Josh was asking questions and getting answers, and so I decided I wanted to ask questions and get some answers.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, here's some questions. Is Josh still alive?
No.
Okay.
Josh, in those first 4 years that he was in the Marine Corps, had been in several firefights, and he had been injured. And he had been given blood. And back in the day, they didn't have a way of screening for AIDS in blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so Josh contracted AIDS. But he was a red-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned individual. And like so many people of that description, he either had an immunity or he had a partial immunity to AIDS. And so it took a very long time for the disease to catch up to him because he had this partial immunity. And then in the 90s, they started coming out with drugs that would treat it. And so he lingered on until December of 2001 when it had finally caught up with him.
Okay, now what about John? Is John still alive? And if so, is he still here on the earth?
I have no reason to believe that he's not still alive, and I have no reason to believe he's not still here. I mean, his mission is to watch and report. He's an anthropologist, so if he shows up, I'm not surprised.
All right. Now, did Josh ever tell you what John looks like, or did you ever meet John?
Unfortunately, yes, I did meet John.
Unfortunately?
Oh, well, you have to picture the situation,
uh-huh.
Kevin, okay? I'm driving. Josh actually lived on a beach on the west coast of Florida, and I'm driving up, and as I did a couple of times a week, but I always came announced because I didn't know if he was in good shape or in bad shape, if he felt like talking, if he didn't feel like talking, and I had found something at a flea market for him that I thought he would like. So I was driving over to his house, and here are these three big Chevy SUVs out, black SUVs out front, and I had never seen them before, and they had government plates on it, and that didn't make me feel too good either. And so I went into his house. I didn't have to knock on his door. That's how close he and I had become in his late days. And this was shortly after September 11th. So I thought, oh, well, they're trying to get him to come back in because they need his help because of September 11th. And, you know, I was thinking they need to leave because this guy is in too bad a shape to help. And so I went in, and here's these guys in their suits, and clearly, you know, these are the real MIB, you know, Men in Black, which was a nickname from the 1950s
mm-hmm.
that people who work behind the Black Book, this is, you know, where they got their budget from, they would say MIB. I mean, now because of the movie, it's a joke, but back in the day, it wasn't a joke. And I walked to the back. I mean, Josh actually had pushed his bed out onto his back porch. So I walked out there, and I walked in, and there he was. And Josh introduced me. And apparently, all the blood rushed out of my head at that point. And I turned white, and my lips went away, because I had no idea how much these men knew, how much they knew about how much I knew about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there were nine of them. I was completely surrounded, and I know John stood up. And because he was on his way out, he said, "How did you do?" in a raspy voice. He actually shook my hand, and he was every bit as creepy as Josh had described him on many, many times. And yeah, so I had my close encounter of the third kind, and I could have gone my entire life without it.
All right, now, you said he's every bit as creepy. We've only got about a minute and a half here before we go to break, so okay. We'll have to make this quick. But let me ask you, when you say he was every bit as creepy as Josh had described him, what does that mean? I mean, did he look human, or what was creepy?
Oh, no, he looked human, okay? As a matter of fact, I can reference him exactly. If you actually saw the original MIB, Men in Black movie, mm-hmm. there is a restaurant scene with this very tall, peepee-looking guy in the restaurant scene. Now, if you take that guy, remove the makeup, and add very tan, leathery skin, that, you know, that's very wrinkled, okay, that guy would have been a perfect ringer for John. Because John was the size, was as tall as a basketball player.
Uh-huh.
And he had this tan, ugly, leathery skin. He looked creepy, and he talked creepy, and he walked creepy, and I was totally creeped out. I had to lay down on the couch, put my feet up. Here you have Josh. He's on his deathbed. He's asking me if there's anything he can do for me. It was just a crazy scene, and I could have gone my entire life without it.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We have to step away for break. We'll pick up there when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with A.J. Ensor this evening. And as I say, he's a TV screenwriter, producer, author. And we're talking about what he has written in the book called Quantum Leap. We'll be back right after this. We are talking this evening to A.J. Ensor about this very fascinating situation, this fascinating case that he's written about in his book called Quantum Leap. And it's not just him reporting on something he heard about. He was actually involved in this. And as we went away for break, A.J., you were... we were commenting on the creepiness of this guy, John. Was there anything, if you didn't already know it before you met him, is there anything about him that would have said to you, this guy's not from this planet?
No, I would have mistaken him for a cancer patient, maybe. That's what I would have mistaken him for. If I crossed paths with him and I never knew who or what he was, that's yeah. I was wondering, Kevin, if everyone who's listening in, if we could give him a common reference page on the internet.
So sure, please do.
www.returnofthedarkside.com, if you scroll down, you will see the Human Quantum Leap. You can just click on it there. That will take you to a digital page. If you want a digital copy, it's less than lunch at McDonald's. But if you want a hard copy, in the same right column, it says buy this in print, and it'll take, you can order it. You can also order it from Barnes & Noble's and a half dozen other bookstores, so if that's what you prefer to do. But and then Return of the Dark Side is my American competitor for Harry Potter. So if you're a Harry Potter fan, then the reason I have them on the same page is because I don't like managing more than one page at a time. I'm kind of busy.
Okay. All right, the returnofthedarkside.com, and right after the show we'll get it linked up so you can just click on his picture on my website, and it'll take you right to it. Okay, so there's nothing about this guy, if you just met him on the street, nothing about him that says he's from another planet, but he still has this sort of creepy aura about him. Very strange look. And what about behavior? Were you in contact with him long enough to notice anything about behavior?
No, I just had a howdy do.
Uh-huh.
A howdy do almost put me in my grave.
All right, so
enough, Kevin.
So let's move forward now in time. We understand about Josh. We understand about John. John being the one that's from another planet. Did Josh ever tell you what planet this guy's from?
No, John couldn't tell him. There isn't, and I don't. This is a little strange to hear, but there isn't a word in English that. That would translate into what his world is. John's natural language happens at extremely low decibels. Basically, on Earth, the only thing that can hear him is an elephant. And when he talks his natural language, so there was never a point of him trying to translate anything reference from his language into ours, because it doesn't translate. There's no common frame of reference. I know it's kind of strange for people to have to think like that, but there was no effort in trying to decipher where John was from. My interest always was, and I press this on Josh every time we had a conversation, is about how they managed to travel in space.
Okay, well, how did they do that?
In order to become a space-faring race, you have to go through your own quantum leap. And it's very easy, once you've gone through the process, for several dozens of scientists to come together, say in cyberspace, thinking to one another, not just talking to one another, but sharing their thoughts. And research progresses very quickly this way, as you might imagine, which is one of the reasons John is so interested in what we're doing, because even though his race has been spacefaring for over 300,000 years, and it's been an advanced race for all that time, believe it or not, their records from back in the day, 300,000 years ago, are a little sketchy. So when they come and watch us doing it, they're discovering how they managed to do it. And one of the things you have to learn how to work with in order to become a space-faring race is material that is called stellar core fragment material. And basically, what this stuff is, say, something the size of a penny. It is so dense and so compact, it would weigh as much as all the buildings on the island of Manhattan. So we're talking about something that is just absolutely incredibly dense, And that's because it comes from a dead star. It comes from a star that has collapsed in on itself, but never turned into a black hole. And then something else happened to cause it to explode or to run into something, and the fragments go out into space. Well, they're just, you know, this is an incredibly complex material. It's also very dangerous. So when you start going through the quantum leap, this is one of the materials that you learn how to get your hands on and then to work with. And this material is the basis of their propulsion system. This material is the basis of how they communicate with one another. They use gravity as a propulsion system, and they use gravity as a communication system.
And, would it surprise you to know, I'm sure it wouldn't, but I've got to ask, would it surprise you to know that I know someone and have had conversations with someone who was active in research and in building gravity communication systems?
Right. I'm sure there's multiple theories on using gravity for communication, but you got to have something that can create gravity waves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's one of the things that is so dangerous about their propulsion system. I've read incidences where people have arrived at crash sites, like the incident from 1975 in northern Mexico. The Mexican army goes in, they put this thing up on a trailer, they go into motion. And 30 minutes later, everybody's dead. And that's how the special team from the U.S. Air Force found them. They were dead. Okay. This material that they use, is, you know, one part per billion of what they put into their propulsion system. And, on the Earth, not in motion, it kind of looks like, lava, but It's infinitely more heavier than lava. Even at one part per billion, it's infinitely more heavier. The danger comes is when you put the thing into motion. It'll charge off the magnetosphere of the Earth. The electromagnetic field around the Earth, it'll start charging off of it. And when it reaches its perigee, it'll discharge that. And It'll fry you like a microwave, all because you just put it into motion. And then it can also bring down an entire power grid. We're talking about a minuscule amount of this material building up a charge and somebody accidentally discharging it. And, you know, you could bring down a quarter to the half of the entire power grid of the United States with some of the stuff. So, and that's why crash sites are so dangerous. So that's the material that they work with and that they use for their propulsion. And basically they put it in their containment. They put it in. They put other materials in there with it to stabilize it. And then they put it into motion and they generate a gravity bubble around their craft. And
all right. Gravity, do you think that it's possible, because there's been a bunch of these crashes, or at least it's been reported that there are a bunch of these crashes where either the U.S. or some other government has recovered the craft that crashed. Do you think it's possible by now that we have gravity wave propulsion?
No. I think they're probably experimenting with it. I think that they probably have electromagnetic propulsion. Because Josh, when I told you about the craft that he met John at, that exhibit, okay, the way he described it to me, it's in the book. I think that they probably have some mastery of electromagnetic propulsion, and probably even an electromagnetic shield of some type. Mm-hmm. That would that would make aircraft impervious to attack. But I don't think we have the computer power necessary to come up with gravity propulsion yet.
You know, I think it's certain, absolutely certain, that we have electromagnetic propulsion. And the reason is the guy at NASA, I believe his last name is Warden, W-O-R-D-E-N, I believe that's correct, who is in charge of this program called the 100-Year Starship, made a public statement that it has a completely new propulsion system and that it is electromagnetic propulsion. So if they're building a 100-year starship and they claim it's got electromagnetic propulsion, that pretty much tells you we've got it, and we've got it fairly well perfected because they can use it in a spaceship.
The thing is that an ion propulsion system is a type of electromagnetic propulsion, and we've already seen them test that.
Mm-hmm.
They sent a satellite into deep space with that already.
Yeah, but his statement was
we have an ion propulsion system.
But his statement was that this is a completely new propulsion system, and that it is electromagnetic. So I don't think it's going to be ion. He said it's completely
right.
New. How far do you think?
The big advantage to have an electromagnetic propulsion is that we could neutralize the effect to a certain extent of gravity on a rocket going up, and it would take half the fuel.
Mm-hmm. How far do you think we are from having a gravity wave propulsion system?
We don't have the computer power yet. If you linked all the computers together on this planet, it would take us about 1,000 years to make the first calculation with the computing power that we have now. I mean, the advances in our computer power is one of the things John is here observing us go through. Okay. So I don't think we're there yet. Also, we're not masters of the physics either, because we still think three-dimensionally, and gravity is one-dimensional. And human beings are not wired together properly to think one-dimensionally. I mean, we live in the dimensions of 2, 3, and 4.
All right, we have to step away for a break, AJ. And ladies and gentlemen, we will return right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with A.J. Ensor. And A.J., you were saying we just simply don't have the computing power. I understand that. How far do you think we are from having the computing power to be able to do our first gravity wave propulsion?
Probably the length of the quantum leap itself, you know, 50 to 150 years.
So. Okay. Well, you know, I mean, in relative terms, that's not that long.
No, it's not long at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, what is that, 1.5 lifetimes? Something like that?
Right.
A couple of lifetimes?
Well, as we close in on the quantum leap, our life expectancy is going to get longer and longer, if we don't kill each other off, that is. And also, how they physically move through space is something that our science hasn't even come close to. I mean, we still use in our physics a time factor. I mean, the famous equation E equals mc squared. Okay, I think it's the C that is the time factor. And in one-dimensional space, there's no such thing as time. Actually, in three-dimensional space, time is just a measure of the expansion of the universe, according to John, or according to our scientists, the time it takes this plant to go around its sun.
Yeah.
That's all.
Well, you know, I'll tell you something. The famous E equals MC squared is it's either fiction or all the rest of physics is fiction. Because C stands for the speed of light, which, of course, has a time factor. Okay?
Right.
Well, all the rest of physics says that the speed of light is the fastest speed of the universe. Now, if that's true, how can you square it?
Right. Well, the thing is you have to really get into that theory in depth to fully understand it. I'm not thinking this is the right forum for it, but...
Oh, it's definitely the right forum. Let me tell you this. The speed of light is the horse and buggy speed of the universe.
Right. And see, the universe expands at faster than the speed of light.
That's exactly right.
I've known that for a long time now, okay? But my position is that... that equation represents a three-dimensional observation from a three-dimensional person.
Sure.
And that's what I meant earlier. We're not wired. We're wired for three dimensions, not one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And our three dimensions is an emergent property of the first dimension. And it's all about gravity. And until John... define gravity to me. No, there doesn't exist within our science a definition of gravity. That's why. That's when I felt that John was real. What he was telling Josh, because he handed me a definition of gravity.
What is that definition?
The definition of gravity is that the universe began. When an expansion occurred, or a bubble from one-dimensional space, and what's causing that expansion was the fact that all the forces that we know in science, the electro force, the weak force, the strong force, et cetera, all the quantum, everything. What the bubble was those things separating out and becoming the weak force, the strong force, the electromagnetic force, the quantum forces, okay? That's what three-dimensional space is. Gravity is the tendency of those forces to reunite back in the first dimension. So it's water seeking its own level. All those forces forming a single force within the first dimension. And that's why they can't come up with a true unification theory, because all their theories have time factors in them, and anything that has a time factor is a product of three-dimensional space.
So three-dimensional space is an aberration of the singularity.
Right.
Okay.
Well, it's an emergent property, for sure.
Okay.
It's an explosion, if you want to call it that. And the explosion is continuing, and that's why our universe continues to expand, because the explosion hasn't ended yet.
So when it ends and everything begins moving back towards singularity, we all will gain weight.
No, because just like in any explosion, once it can dissipate. Once, as long as there are black holes forming, we're safe, okay? I mean, it may be 80 billion years into the future, but it's entirely plausible that that matter in three-dimensional space can become detached from the first dimension and then just dissipate like smoke.
Ooh, now that would be interesting.
Right, see.
Do you have any suspicion that the government would tell us if that was about to happen?
No, because they wouldn't know.
If they knew, I don't think they would tell us. Okay.
No,
let's talk about John's observations of us as an anthropologist. How does he think we're doing?
I haven't actually had that conversation per se with Josh, but I think he knows about our fiction. He knows about Star Trek. I mean, apparently, when Josh asked him about that one time, that's the first time he ever saw John laugh. And you have to imagine that there are extraordinary exotic particles out in space that have no mass and no charge, and so you're in a spacecraft that's flying through this stuff, igniting a material that has no charge. Suddenly it starts collapsing on itself, and that's not how you travel in space, anywho. So he would get a good laugh. I mean, he knew what Star Trek was. But, you know, he also raised, I remember, conversation about borders also. We have borders. It's one of the things that Marcus, from his perspective, there's no difference between the person living on the U.S. side of the border and the person living on the Mexican side of the border. He can't see it. All right, and so that to him is tribalism. That and his example was, you know, that's the same as the lions going out and peeing on the bushes. There's no difference. So, other than us being extremely primitive and that making us very dangerous, he's seen many races and he knows a great deal about many races. There isn't anything particularly unique about us, other than we live on this particular planet. That's all, and we evolved here.
So, does he say that there are others of our same species, call it human or whatever, out there scattered throughout the universe?
There are humanoids. People, races that grew up on the similar circumstance or evolved on the similar circumstances, but anyone listening in has to understand that there is no place like Earth in the rest of the universe. There is no place that has our exact level of gravity. There is no place that has our exact atmosphere. So that's why John looks the way he does. In the book, The Human Quantum Leap, I struggle, and I left this in the book during the revision, to let people see that I was struggling to explain how John exists on our planet.
Okay, we're going to have to get that when we come back, because we have a break that's going to take over here in about 5 seconds or so. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back more with A.J. Enser in just a moment. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. Sorry for whatever it is that kept you from that first hour, but we're glad you're here now. And we're talking with A.J. Enser. He is the author of The Human Quantum Leap. We've sort of titled this show, What's Next for Our Species? And that's kind of what we've been talking about, this process of achieving the quantum leap into what's next. AJ, let me ask you this question, and then we'll open the phone lines for our audience to join us. But are there others on this planet like John? In other words, is he alone here, or is he part of a team?
No, he's not part of a team. There may be two or three others. That's all he, two or three is all he's ever met, according to Josh. But we get visited all the time. It's just that people don't stay. This, first of all, they don't come here because of us. They're, you know, they're not looking for a conversation with us. And but we get visited all the time, and the people and the races that are interested in us, they might have a representative here like John. But like I said, John's only met two or three other races other than the human race.
Mm-hmm.
He knows about hundreds, but he's only met two or three.
Okay. So basically, John and others that are like him on this planet are here basically on recon missions, right?
No, they're just they're anthropologists. They're just looking. Everyone else comes here because of our solar system. They're interested in our solar system. We have an extremely unique solar system, and so that's why from time to time you get UFO sightings.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, a UFO sighting represents a mistake. Somebody screwed up, or there's some technical problem. But for the most part, they come here to study our solar system.
Okay.
We got nothing to do with it. I know people hate hearing this, but there's nothing I can do about it. It's not about us.
All right. I want to invite our audience to join the conversation, and we do that by inviting you to activate your transporter. Your transporter looks like, and everyone calls it, a telephone. The coordinates are 623-444-5889. When you put those coordinates into that transporter, it will transport you right here to the bridge of the KSS Starship, and you can talk with me, you can talk with our guest, A.J. Enser, and you can make a comment, you can ask a question, you can join the conversation. To the telephone and caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Jerome from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Jerome.
Hi. Mr. Enser, you mentioned that this John, he's some part of a galactic federation. Is that what you said?
I didn't get all that, Kevin.
He wants to know if you said that John is part of some type of galactic federation.
No. They have rules that they go by, but they're not part of any kind of federation. They're just individual races, like we're an individual race.
And you said that we're not going to be able to make the quantum leap until we become more advanced.
Well, we don't have enough computer power right now. We cannot form a group mind or a scientific mind inside cyberspace. We have still using our hands on the type. But many universities have already adapted technology so that paraplegics can use computers. I mean, we're on the way. When we're able to send our thoughts through the internet, not just our words, so the leap would be on its way for sure then.
Mm-hmm. You except for this one time that you met John. All your other observations are through Josh. Is that correct?
Right. That is correct. Yes.
Okay, and you mentioned that you said that John, the one time you met him, you said that he made you seemed like you said you wish you'd never had met him. But when you describe him, the only thing you described was, you said, like a cancer patient. I've met 10 cancer patients, and I didn't have the same reaction to that. I wasn't all creeped over, you know what I'm saying?
You misunderstand. I knew who I was meeting. He didn't know who he was meeting. He didn't know who I was. I knew who he was. Okay. This was a one-way reaction. Okay, and then and it was mine because I was scared. I was surrounded by these government agents, and they did not know how much I knew about them. What I knew about them is illegal. And, Josh violated security telling me this stuff. And I didn't want. I was not interested in suffering the consequences of that.
I understand that. When you walked in on John and these MIBs were there, were they startled that you walked in? I mean, it seems like they didn't secure the place.
No, they were not startled. We didn't even have a conversation. I just kept going every time I saw one guy, and he looked like a regular guy dressed in a suit and tie. I would just say, hello, how are you? Josh's wife was there, and she was calling, saying hello to me, telling me that Josh was out on the porch. And I just kept walking on through. It was a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
Until, of course, I saw John.
And that, you said that John never disclosed his location of his home planet. Is that correct? Or is this something we couldn't understand?
No, I never disclosed his name. I was told once where he was located 20 years ago, but I'm sorry, that information was lost to time. I mean, I try to think about where it was again. I just could not remember.
Okay, and also John ever mention anything about human abductions or chemtrails?
Josh raised that issue with him one time, and John thought it was an interesting phenomenon that he wasn't completely understood about, because the technology these people possess would allow them to scan you right down to your DNA from orbit in space. And they don't come here because of us. They don't come here looking for us. So John simply considered it an interesting phenomenon. The only thing he ever came up with over a 20-year period about this subject was that copying somebody's memories, having a human perspective in the galactic internet, as that's my phrase for it, galactic internet, that people could plug into, that might be a reason to grab a human and put him back again. But experimentation, it doesn't make any sense. It didn't make sense to Josh or John, because they can type your DNA and they can track wherever you go by your DNA. They can know where you are anytime you want by your DNA. They don't need to implant technology to find you. And they can know everything you're doing from orbit. So it never made sense to John. And also, there's a certain amount of paranoia associated with this kind of conduct. And paranoia, that's very human. That's a human phenomenon. That's not John and other people like him. They're not like that.
Well, I think that's an interesting insight that. All they're interested in is our part of the universe, really, and not us.
Right. We're very primitive, and we're not real significant yet. You know, we're not making any contributions anywhere, and we kill each other, and we make wars, and they don't have any common frame of reference with us. And that's why they're not interested. They got other stuff to do.
Okay, Jerome, I want to thank you for the call. As always, very interesting questions. I appreciate it very much. 623-444-5889, 623-444-5889. As always, if you are outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, we understand that international long-distance calls can be expensive, so you can either call that number, it'll work, or if you're outside the USA, outside of Canada, you can use the flash message feature on my website. Just go to my website, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show, and right above the picture you'll see the link that says flash message. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, Kevin. This is Terry from Ohio.
Hello, Terry. How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
Good.
Been a while.
It has.
Yes. I'd like to... Your guest mentioned that John knew only, like, a couple of different races, but your guest said that there was hundreds. How does he know that there's hundreds? Can he explain that?
Sure. No, he's only met two or three others. And John knows about hundreds of other races because, for lack of a better explanation, there exists a galactic internet. And I'm just using that as a reference, people. I'm not... One of the elements of the human quantum leap is that we discover this way of communicating with gravity, okay, which plugs us in to their net, and part of the leap is getting information from sources outside of our solar system via this net. That's part of the quantum leap, okay? But John knows about hundreds of races. He's only met two or three of them. You have to understand that the only way John can meet other races is on common ground, right? Our planet would be considered common ground, but they would have to go through this same kind of genetic engineering that John has gone through in order to be here and to shake each other's hands, okay? They're from completely different environments, and those environments are hostile to one another.
I was wondering, yeah, because like you say, we go through this quantum thing, so it seems like we're all headed for the same destination. Do we all evolve almost into the same thing, or do we have to maintain our element, you know, to survive on this planet?
Everyone's an individual. Individualism starts with one person. Okay, and even if you enter into a group mind, you remain an individual. You're sharing like you would share a conversation. And it's the same thing with these people. I mean, even when we get to the galactic internet, I would imagine that most of them aren't going to want to talk with us. But then you have groups like John's race or the others who have been observing us. And they might be willing to talk to us because John's here, and they have a common frame of reference to communicate with us.
Yeah, you mentioned that you know they really have no interest in us. Is there any that have any interest in helping us evolve, or are we on our own?
We're on our own. John would even save Josh. And I would think that Josh was probably the closest thing he had to a friend, and John would not intervene.
Okay.
So we are on our own, and we will evolve on our own because you know that's part of their rules.
And well, I know he's talking about time, and I have a problem with you know any existence without time. No matter what dimension you're in, there would have to be time, you know, or there wouldn't, you know. How would you know? I couldn't fathom an existence, you know, in a time pattern, you know, to live. Even if it's infinite, there still would be a time factor, even though you could.
Well, Could you imagine a world without money in it?
Not right now.
No. Well,
you better start imagining it.
Right.
Yeah, they're working on it. Yeah.
But any dogs or cats or anything, do they know what to do with money?
That's true. There's still time. You know, they still, the dogs, you know, even have a shorter lifespan, you know, like 7 years to our, you know, whatever.
Right, right. Actually, you're the perfect caller for this one, because you have come up with the, you're talking about the paradox of what it means to be human and not able to think one-dimensionally. Okay, you can't fathom it because you're not wired to, you're not plugged in. You know, you're not a theoretical physicist using math to describe it. Okay.
Well, listen, I have to admit, I cannot think in one dimension either.
Right. Well,
I mean, I can see men in space, you know, and like going through wormholes and going from one place to another. But yet, once you get there, you're back into time.
Well, actually, Kevin, I think you can, because and you do special effects when you edit video.
Yeah.
Okay. And you have to decide where that effect is going to come in and go out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When it comes in and you're using the effect, you're in the three dimensions, but where it's coming in and out of, that's the first dimension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, even God, or I don't bring God factor in it, but I mean, even in that, you know, he says, you know, a day is like 1,000 years to God, you know, and he's eternal. So, you know, it seems like time is an infinite part of existence.
Well, I don't know.
Right.
Now, wait a minute. Well, what you're quoting there, Terry, is he says 1,000 years, one day is as 1,000 years, 1,000 years as one day.
Right.
Okay, it has two parts. So when you put the two together, it means time means nothing to him. A day is as 1,000 years. 1,000 years is as a day. It just has no meaning.
Yeah,
well,
he's trying to tell us that it doesn't mean anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're facing the paradox, Jerry, okay? And
Terry.
Every human being has to face that paradox in order to understand the way the universe exists and how we got here, okay? And there's no way not to face that and to get past that paradox in order to come to that understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm with you, Terry. I have a hard time wrapping my mind around one dimension where there is no time. I can theoretically accept that it exists. I cannot say that I understand that.
Yeah.
I have trouble with it too, friends. I have trouble with it too.
Yeah.
And one of the little mind tricks, and this is a mind trick, this is, don't anyone start quoting me on this one, okay? One of the mind tricks I do is, because I do video edit professionally, if you take a box, a three-dimensional box, and you put it into a video matrix, you look at it on your computer, that box, you can see its length, you can see its width, you can imagine its height. Okay, you have a sense of its mass. Okay, but then as you look at it, what is it sitting in?
You're right. It's sitting in a flat screen.
No, it's sitting on a first dimension. You are looking at three dimensions on a first dimensional screen. Now, that's not a scientific example, folks. That is just a little mind trick that I play with myself in order to remind myself what the first dimension is.
When you make a box like that, can't you do that and look at it in four dimensions when you draw it like that in, you know, in a one-dimensional screen or whatever?
You can turn it within the matrix itself, and essentially when you turn it around like they do with CAT scans or MRIs, when they rotate it around, it's sitting in a one-dimensional matrix, and it's turning its three dimensions inside of it. It's really a perfect little mind trick to try to understand what the first dimension is, but it's not a scientific example, though.
Yeah. Terry, thank you for the call. It's good to hear from you again. Don't wait so long before you call again.
Yeah, I think I would. Take care.
All right. Boy, that's a good example. A very good example, because you're looking at it on a one-dimensional screen, and it's showing you three dimensions on the one-dimensional
right.
screen.
And, you know, special effects editors can get this frontal lobe headache. I don't know if you've ever experienced it, but I've known quite a few editors who have. And my theory is that the pain is coming from having to think one-dimensionally in order to do special effects editing.
Yeah, it's sometimes you can conceptualize what you want to do on the screen, and figuring out how to make that happen can really be tough sometimes.
It really migraine.
Yeah. All right, ladies and gentlemen, 623-444-5889. Those are the coordinates you need to dial into your transporter, generally called a telephone, and it will transport you here where you can talk with our guest, A.J. Enser. You can ask your questions, make your comments, and we would love to hear from you. We have a flash message from Cambodia. Cambodia. Now, wait a minute. Hang on just a second.
Cambodia.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. From Cambodia, from Van Van in Cambodia. The incident in Australia with the boar, was it near Pine Gap?
I don't actually know the answer to this question, but I have to tell you that in the book I reference something called the United States Territory of Australia, and I simply put that in there the way I heard it. I don't know what it is. I have reasons to believe that there is a 50 by 50 square mile piece of Aussie, the land of Oz, I call it, the reason it exists is so that Australia can say that there are no nuclear weapons within its territory. And that's my understanding as to why it exists. But I don't know where it is, and I've never been able to confirm its existence. But that's where Josh said this happened at.
All right, second question from Van in Cambodia. Does John know whether Earthlings have been sent to other planets to do the same job that John is doing here?
No, not. We would have to do that on our own. They don't. You know, like I said before, abduction is a phenomenon John had never had a good explanation for, and didn't understand it, and he viewed it as a human phenomenon, not an intergalactic or alien phenomenon.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people that have come to the same conclusion that abductions that people say are extraterrestrial abduction are in the majority human orchestrated. They call them MILABs,
yeah,
or military abductions.
Beyond having conversations with you, Kevin, I've never really been into UFO culture.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not a big UFO watcher of television or reader or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason I know what I know is because of Josh. And in the absence of Josh, I would never, ever have done any of this.
All right. We have to step away for a break. We shall return in just a moment, and we will have the telephone lines open and awaiting your call.
Hot Arizona, but nothing's hotter than the Kevin Smith Show.
And this is Kevin Smith at the Hot Kevin Smith Show. We are talking with A.J. Enser, and we're talking about some really, really mind-bending stuff here this evening, contained in his book called The Human Quantum Leap. And again, if you want to get that book, you can get it digitally or you can get it in print. And the way you do it is go to... what is it? The Return of the Dark Side? Well, you know, AJ, it helps if I push the right button. It's the Return of the Dark Side.com, right?
Right. Returning, then you scroll down and you'll see the Human Quantum Leap. And the book on top is my Harry Potter competitor.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. We've all heard the stories about extraterrestrials working with the military in various stories, various roles, and so forth. Now, tonight, what we're talking about is an extraterrestrial who is an anthropologist. That's what we would call him. And how long, AJ, how long has he been here on this planet? Do you know?
Since we qualified for first contact, according to their rules. That was my understanding of how long he's been here. There are two qualifiers for that. The first of which is you have to use subatomic structure as a tool. The use of subatomic structure as a tool, unfortunately, a nuclear weapon qualifies, but also generating electricity with nuclear power qualifies. And then you have to have some type of artificial intelligence, a thinking machine. And the United States was the first to advance both of those, and that's why we're the government they made contact with.
How do we know they didn't make contact with the old Soviet Union and today Russia? How do we know they didn't do that? Or with China now?
We don't. We don't know. I don't know. If I did know, I would tell you. But it's unlikely because we're viewed as so dangerous that they would want to limit contact in the extreme. As a matter of fact, contact is a last resort for them. And so if they're going to make a last resort, they're going to make it just with one group of people that they think they can, communicate with.
Do you think that this race of extraterrestrials that John represents, do you think they had any notion, any idea that the very people they were going to contact and deal with think in terms of weaponizing anything and everything they can get their hands on?
Sure, surely. That's why they won't help us with technology. That's what I mean. They're not going to give us anything that's going to advance our understanding of weapons technology. But there's nothing they can do about spacecraft that crash here that belong to other races that, you know, the Air Force picks up and carts off to God knows where and does backward engineering on it. Okay, their non-interference extends universally, even if we find something as dangerous as an interstellar space vehicle.
So what's in it for the U.S. government if they're not going to get a transfer of technological knowledge? Then why would the U.S. government be escorting John around and pay any attention to him at all if they're not going to get anything out of him?
My impression was, and I don't know this to be true, my impression was that the dialogue with John was enough. Just the dialogue. So, I guess there's non-lethal information they might be exchanging there. Sorry to disappoint you, Kevin.
Well, you don't disappoint me. I'm puzzled because that runs counter to what we know about the way our government and our military and our intelligence apparatus operate.
If you've seen the WikiLeaks, we have secret dialogues all the time about things that we don't want anybody to know anything about. And understand the protocol of the intelligence community, once a project like John, for example, once it has a charter, okay, in order for that project to travel back up the chain of command, there would have to be an exception created to the charter of the of whatever the project is. Okay, so in theory, you know, Theodore Truman or Eisenhower could have established a protocol, and so long as that protocol, there is no exception made to it, there's no reason for the people running the project to travel back up the chain of command. So it
takes on a life of its own.
It's reasonable that the sitting president of the United States wouldn't know anything about it, okay? The only way he would find out is if he instructed the inspector general to conduct an audit of the intelligence project, and then he's going to find out information he definitely doesn't want to know. So,
or he could read your book.
Happening either.
Yeah, or he could read your book.
Yeah, but still, if he wanted to pin it down, I have enough in that opening chapter there to discourage any experienced investigator from finding out who Josh is. Okay, just enough mistakes there, and I intended that, and I admit it freely. I'm sorry people find that very suspect, but I'm rather intent that people not find out who Josh was.
Why?
Because that was my promise to him. That was my promise. And Josh said that he would share stuff with me so long as no one ever found out it was him. That was my promise. And
well, I can understand that. I certainly can understand.
And when he was dying, he opened up. When he knew he was on his way out, he started talking a lot. So.
What's the most amazing thing, from your perspective, the most amazing thing that Josh ever told you about this John?
What John told him, how the earth formed?
How did the earth form?
This is the reason they come here, Kevin, and it's the reason there's a second edition to the book and the reason why there's a new chapter at the end. It's what... It's why, you know, we exist, and the way it goes like this. One of the things that the visitors who come here are looking for is a race that no longer exists. They went extinct, okay? And for lack of a better word, John called them the Ancient Ones. And I don't like that because it's been used in our fiction, okay? But if you use, like right now, NASA and its associate universities, they're trying to catalog as much of the Milky Way as they can see from where we exist inside the Milky Way. They're using specialized satellites to Earth-like solar systems, and they're trying to define them. By type. And what they're going to find out over the next 50 years is that there are 50 to 150 systems like our system in this galaxy. They're not exactly like this system. They have the same basics, the same kind of sun, the same kind of planets, but none of them are the same. Okay, and what they're also going to find out is that, as in all scientific research, when you catalog these types of systems or type them, it's going to form a bell curve on a statistical chart. Okay, and then there's all the other 4 billion star systems in the Milky Way, and those systems are going to form a bell curve on a statistical chart using the scientific method. But the one for the rest of the 4 billion and the one for the 50 to 150 that are like ours, they mesh. There's a paradigm shift. And what they're going to find out is that in a Milky Way galaxy like ours, a system like ours forms 1 to 7 times per billion. So right now, across the entire life lifespan of the Milky Way, we're looking at maybe somewhere between 7 and 21 possible systems like ours. But there's more. There's 50 to 150. And why is that? Well, that has to do with what we started this program with, their propulsion system. In order to travel in space, you have to learn how to use stellar core fragment material. But propulsion is not the only thing that it's good for. So if we go back in time, about 4.7 to 5 billion years or years ago, in this part of our galaxy, there was a supernova explosion. And what you wound up with is systems like our system, and there's Sirius, and there's Vega, and there's Proxima, and then there's Centauri Alpha. And these systems are the end result of that explosion, but they're all binary, except this system. Our system has one star. And so what John and others like him originally came here to do was to study how this system formed. And they believe that this ancient race, who they believe they know where that race came from, but their star is dead and their race is extinct. They believe that this ancient race took stellar core fragment material of a particular size and a particular mass and used a computer program to lay out a system in the event horizon of this supernova explosion. And in doing so, they created a gravitational trap. In other words, like a vacuum cleaner for stellar material. And so they laid out our sun, and they laid out Jupiter, and they laid out Saturn and Neptune and the big gas giants, okay? And then they came back 100,000 years, and they had the kind of sun that they wanted, and they had the other planets that they wanted. But the distance between Jupiter and our sun is the standard deviation of their model. There was no way for them to know how that was going to come out when they first created the gravitational trap. So now they come back with more stellar core fragment material, and using a smaller model, they put stellar material in orbit around this now forming star, and then they come back 100 to 500,000 years later, and lo and behold, we have Earth Mark 1.
Okay, we'll get the rest of that on the other side of the break. Fascinating stuff, folks. When we come back, we will have the opportunity to call in and talk with AJ for a few minutes, and then the window closes. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are, ladies and gentlemen, on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left in tonight's show. If you've been sitting on your fingers saying, I want to call, but I am scared, you got to get over it, like right now, because the window's closing. We have a little bit of time left in which you can call, and then we'll close the phone lines. And land the starship. We're talking with AJ Enser. AJ, this is an incredible story about how all of this was created. I don't want to give it all away here. Folks do need to grab the book so they can read.
There is so much more in the book.
Okay.
Two hours on a radio program, we haven't even scratched it yet.
Well, I would agree. I've read the book, I would agree.
Okay.
All right. So, where do we go from here? What's the thing we need to do?
I would be patience. That's the only thing. I mean, the book opens with the explanation that the current generation of people living on this planet are unlikely to see the human quantum leap or to experience it. It's not impossible. Not impossible, but it's extremely unlikely. And to understand, people, I don't like the paranoia that I see when people start shouting UFO, UFO, UFO. So I think that the book provides an explanation of who they are and why they're coming. And in the last segment, you heard why it is they're so fascinated with our system, and it's got nothing to do with us.
Well, the only paranoia I see associated with anything to do with UFO, the only paranoia exists among the major media and the mushroom population. The informed are not paranoid at all.
Right, yeah. Still, I met John and I got ill, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But,
I don't count that as one of my great experiences in life.
Yeah. Major media are basic dumbasses when it comes to UFO. And not all of them, but I'm using a wide brush there. And I said what I said. It applies, and I mean it. They are totally uninformed because they choose to be. And they are the ones who perpetrate the paranoia into, and they infuse it into the mushroom mind, not the cyber mind or the group mind, but the mushroom mind with the herd instinct of the population of this planet. But for those who have broken away from the herd and are individuals again and are informed, there's no paranoia about it. I hear people say, oh, well, you know, if there is disclosure, it's a game changer. Everything changes. And I've asked over and over and over again, AJ, how does it change anything? It doesn't change.
I don't see how it does, okay?
Yeah.
It may be just, one of John's rules.
But disclosure doesn't change anything. And here's why. Let's say there is some phenomena out there in the galaxy or out beyond our galaxy, and we'll call it, a quaddle, okay? I don't know what it is, but it's a quaddle. Nobody here on Earth knows there's a quaddle out there. The day the quaddle is discovered, nothing changes. It was already there.
The thing is this, Kevin. I have been in groups even before I wrote The Quantum Leap. And, intelligent, educated, among intelligent some of Josh's stories with that group, okay, and them slowly coming to realize that I wasn't BSing them.
Uh-huh.
I've seen the paranoia happen.
Well, I'm unmerciful about that. It's time. I don't care how many doctor's degrees they have. It's time for them to just grow up. This is a universe that operates way beyond these little tinker toys they call the laws of physics. And they aren't laws. What those are is majority opinion of description of
that the human mind can live with.
Well, it's a comfort zone. And,
right, okay,
you know,
yeah, that's good.
And, it's time to grow up. And, if learning that things are not like you were taught, and if learning that your government will lie to you and has, if learning that the universe cannot fit in a teacup, if that upsets somebody, it's time to grow up. And, I've met people with PhDs that were absolute idiots, And, you know, and I'm not somebody that is sitting out here without a doctor's degree saying that because I'm jealous. I have a doctor's degree. I don't wear it on my sleeve. But I've met PhDs that are absolute idiots. And it's just time for them to grow up.
You're talking to a PhD.
Yeah, but, well, it's time for it's time for everybody to grow up.
My PhD has nothing to do with the sciences.
Okay.
I mean, my PhD is in audience research. In other words, it has absolutely nothing to do with any of the material that we're talking about here. And I don't even put it on my resume. There was even a time when I was working in media in New York and LA and Chicago where I didn't even put my master's degree up because I wouldn't get a job.
Yeah.
I was unemployable. Okay.
Well, but see, the point is this. Having the degrees doesn't mean we're smarter. It does not mean we're more mature. And it doesn't make what we say more true just
right.
because we have them.
I agree
them.
Totally.
And there are people, this whole world is based on status and it's based on credentials, and there are people that wear that stuff on their sleeve. And then you tell them something that's outside their box and it upsets them. Well, they just need to grow up. They're just being childish. And
right.
I don't think the information that's in your book should upset anybody. I don't think disclosure should upset any apple cart. And the only apple carts that it will upset are the ones that really need to be upset. The only thing it's ever going to destroy are the things that need to be destroyed.
Well, the reason I left that last chapter out in the first edition was because I was afraid of backlash from religious groups. I'd figure, if I don't have to step on anybody's toes, why bother? But then people were on, what did you leave out? Why don't you put it back in, yada, yada, yada. So I put it back. Now it's there.
Well,
now you know.
Yeah, well, I don't try to step on anybody's toes, but I don't try to avoid it either. If they shove their foot right up under me, well, you know, hey. But the point of all of this is people are living lives of fiction. They're living lives in a fictional setting. And, you know, when it upsets them, if it upsets them that they discover that it's what they're all about is fiction, well, you know, they just have to be upset, and then it's time to grow up. Because reality is reality. Whether a person believes something or not doesn't make it more true. If they do believe it, it doesn't make it more true. If they don't believe it, it doesn't make it less true. If it's true, it's true. And so they need to, you know, and I'm all for getting information out. I'm all for getting information to people. And, you know, the results out there are just the results. Whatever happens, happens.
I take an awful lot of flack on Facebook.
Yeah, but look, people, the only insignificant people on the planet are the ones who think you are. And the only people who don't matter are the ones who think you don't matter. Think about it. All right, we got to check out of here. We're out of time. Stay on the phone line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be it for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye, my enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.